Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by DataPipe Managed IT Services, delivering a comprehensive suite of managed services, including implementing, securing, and scaling applications designed for mid-market and Fortune 1000 enterprises. DataPipe.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. So of all the people you might expect to see in a photo with the Wall Street Journal science columnist, maybe the Dalai Lama is not one of them, but there it is in the new book by Wall Street Journal science columnist Sharon Begley. The journal, or the book, I should say, calls itself a groundbreaking collaboration between neuroscience and Buddhism, and the Dalai Lama wrote the foreword. It's called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, published by Ballantine Books. It relates to everything from fighting disease and depression, to recovering from strokes, to challenging the notion that there is such a thing as a happiness set point. Sharon Begley joins me now. Thanks so much for coming into WNYC to talk about this. Good morning.
Thank you, Brian.
Is this really about a collaboration between neuroscience and Buddhism?
Well, it is, in the sense that the Dalai Lama, in addition to receiving scientists at his home in northern India, reciprocates by lending his monks to experiments. And that's because, you know, he has long been interested in science. He's said that if this whole, you know, reincarnation of the 13th Dalai Lama didn't happen, he would have become a scientist or an engineer. And he has parlayed that interest into this collaboration where when his monks go to the United States, you know, to do teachings or to visit, they stop off at a laboratory at the University of Wisconsin to have their brain scanned. So in that sense, he is participating in the research.
What are the scientists looking for when they scan the brain of a Buddhist monk?
The idea is to see whether long-term mental training, and meditation is just a form of mental training, leaves an enduring mark on the brain. You know, when the brain does anything, of course, you're going to be able to find some telltale activity there. So, I mean, to me, that's not that exciting when you see all the pretty pictures and newspapers and magazines. So this is your brain thinking about going shopping, and this is your brain thinking about what it's going to have for dinner. Well, of course, the brain has activity whenever you're thinking about anything. What's more interesting is when the brain, during its down periods, shows a difference as a result of something that you have done in your waking hours. So in this case, meditation, yes, there is a activity in the brain when the monks are actually meditating. But more interesting is that these patterns of activity persist even when they're not meditating, which suggests that, again, this form of mental training has left an enduring footprint in the brain.
How do they measure that footprint? I heard, for example, a reference to a study, and I have no idea whether this is true, so don't base your cardiovascular health on it, but I heard about a study that says that it found that doing TM, transcendental meditation, reduces blood pressure, but only for the time that you're meditating.
Exactly, which is why you want something that's more enduring because, you know, you can meditate for an awful lot of hours during the day, but let's face it, we're not going to do it for 24 hours. But yes, TM, other forms of meditation, do have at least a temporary effect on blood pressure, on stress levels, on a lot of other good things. So, you know, they may not be exactly equivalent to working out at the gym, but they're definitely beneficial to cardiovascular health. The brain research that the Dalai Lama has been collaborating on looks at a form of meditation called compassion meditation, which, again, in Tibetan Buddhism, is an activity in which you have the wish, you think about, you focus on the hope that all sentient beings will be free of suffering. And, you know, when you say it that way, it sounds, well, okay, I can sit and think that till I'm blue in the face, but what difference will it really make? Well, you know, these are monks who have practiced this for, in many cases, thousands and thousands of hours. And it turns out that when they do so, the more hours they have been engaged in this form of meditation, the higher the activity in the part of the brain that gives rise to feelings of compassion, altruism, empathy. So it's at least a little bit of a piece of evidence that this form of mental training can change the brain, again, in an enduring way, not just in the temporary way of when you're meditating, but in a way that carries over.
When you say to get rid of suffering, to eliminate suffering, I know that's the language that the English translations of some of this Buddhism uses. Is the most enlightened Buddhist monk free of suffering, or is that a utopian impossibility?
None of those who I met are free of suffering, and they're actually not in the best of cardiovascular health either. Those robes are definitely covering something in their midsections. But I have to say, when I was over in Dharamsala to write about the meeting that's the core of this book, this was between a half a dozen neuroscientists and the Dalai Lama. From his side, as it were, he brought a number of Buddhist scholars, practicing monks, lamas, scholars, and they do have just this sense of equanimity, of calm, and of kindness that, you know, I'm sure I'm bringing, you know, some expectations to it, but...
Do they have families? Do they have college bills?
Well, they don't, so there is something to be said for this whole, you know, monastic life thing. But, you know, they don't live easy lives. I mean, one of the monks who participated most directly in the work at the University of Wisconsin, looking at the brain activity during meditation, he lives in Nepal, which, of course, has had horrible political troubles and indeed an incipient revolution. And he builds medical clinics and schools out in the countryside. So it's not an easy life at all. Actually, I've heard from a number of Wall Street Journal readers asking me, well, what good does it do to, you know, sit around and just sort of feel compassionate and feel empathic and feel altruism if you just sit in the monastery and feel that? That's actually does not characterize most of these monks. They are out in the world trying to do good.
My guest is Wall Street Journal science columnist Sharon Begley. Her new book is Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, How a New Science Reveals Our Extraordinary Potential to Transform Ourselves, with a foreword by the Dalai Lama. The concept of neuroplasticity is central to your book. What is that?
It just means what the two parts of the word would suggest. Neuro refers, of course, to the brain, and plasticity means the ability to change. So in this case, it means the ability of the adult brain to change its function and, to some extent, its structure in response to experience, in response to the life we lead. And this, of course, is very different from the old idea of the hardwired brain, which had been neurodogma for decades and decades, the idea that the brain that you reach the ripe old age of 3 with is the brain you're going to be stuck with forever. And that just turns out to be completely wrong and also awfully depressing. So thank goodness it's wrong.
So in general, though, a child's brain is different from a grown-up's brain in terms of neuroplasticity?
It is still more plastic, more malleable than the brain of somebody who has, you know, reached retirement age. But even someone who is in his 50s, 60s, 70s, and this has been shown with stroke patients, those brains also have an impressive amount of adaptability, which, you know, of course, is what you want if you're trying to recover from stroke, if you're trying to learn a new skill, if you're, you know, trying to keep your memory intact. So it's a fairly optimistic message.
And you write about how sensory experience can reshape adult brains. Give me an example.
I'll give the example that I found coolest was when you play the violin, your fingering digits, those are the fingers usually on your right hand that, you know, run up and down the strings of the instrument, the part of the brain that controls those actually expands the more you practice. So it's, of course, a region of the motor cortex, which is the part of the brain that sends signals to tell various body parts to move. And the more you practice, the greater the expansion there. But what was even more interesting was, now to switch instruments a second to the piano, in one very cool experiment, the scientist had volunteers play a little piano exercise, and exactly as you would imagine, the region of their brain that controls the fingers expanded, and that has to do with also greater facility with the instrument. When more brain real estate is devoted to that skill, you tend to be better at it. But he also had people just sit in the lab and think about playing that little piano exercise. And they came in day after day for 5 days, for several hours a day, again, just looking at the sheet music and thinking, I'm playing this, this is how I would move my fingers. And the mere thought of doing that also led to an expansion of the motor cortex, exactly analogous to that which the people who actually touched the ivories experienced as well. So this was another piece of evidence that, I'm tempted to say mere thought, but it's probably not mere anymore, but that thought acts back on the brain that produces it to change the physical structure of the brain.
So that exercise you were just describing, would they do something like that with, say, a stroke victim who may not be able to actually play the piano anymore with her fingers?
With stroke, it's hugely important that you focus on whatever the rehab is. And, you know, especially for stroke patients who were many years post-stroke and who had not recovered, they really had been given up on by the rehab community. But it turns out that a particular therapy, it's called constraint-induced movement therapy, in which, let's say, your left arm has been paralyzed as a result of the stroke, you're prevented from using your right arm so that you have to do everything with your left. And these patients say, well, what do you mean? I can't move my left arm at all. But whether the therapist physically moves it for you or simply helps you, it turns out that, in fact, that arm is not as useless as you thought. And what happens in the brain is that if you had a lesion in a particular region that caused that left arm to be paralyzed, through this therapy, you can get a different region of the brain to pinch hit for that injured part. And so that's, again, a very striking example of plasticity.
But it's not physical therapy in the sense that we usually think of it. It's mental therapy.
The mental part is so important because, exactly analogous to the piano experiment, if you think about this activity, it's not really clear how it works, but clearly something having to do with the electrical conductivity of the brain, the neurochemicals sloshing around in there, all of those get dialed up in a way which turns out to, you know, basically give people the movement of their arm back.
Wall Street Journal science correspondent Sharon Begley, my guest on WNYC, author of Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, with a foreword by the Dalai Lama. What is this concept of the happiness set point?
Yeah, talk about depressing. It's the idea that, analogous to our weight set point, you know, it's very hard to lose weight once you get above where you would like to be. We similarly have a happiness set point, a level of well-being, of satisfaction with life that we are going to be stuck at no matter how many wonderful things happen to us. And this is, again, not only depressing, but turns out to be empirically wrong. In other words, if there's a scale of happiness from 1 to 10, the idea was, if you're a 6 now, you're always going to be a 6. And if you're a 3, you're always going to be a 3. But most people can, in fact, move up or down, unfortunately, by 3 or more points, which is fairly significant.
Out of 10.
Yeah, which is why it's significant. And the reason this ties back to neuroplasticity is that there's a particular brain pattern that tends to correlate with, again, a sense of well-being. We're not talking about, you know, just constant jollies, but just sort of day-to-day you're satisfied with your life.
So again, is it meditation? Is it the Buddhist practice of mindfulness that expands this happiness set point or changes it up?
Well, that's one of the things that does. And what it does is increase activity in the left part of the brain, which seems to be where this sense of well-being comes from. And that was shown in the monks who indeed had a off-the-charts level of happiness. And, you know, you might say, well, if you're a monk, maybe you were happy to begin with, and that's why you chose that life. And the scientists were very cognizant of that, so they controlled for it. And it does seem to be a very robust finding. But, you know, for those of us who are not going to dedicate our lives to meditation, you know, people ask, do I meditate? And my answer always is, when I decide it's safe to do so on the New York City subway, then, you know, count me in. But until then, there are things that indeed can shift the happiness set point, again, based on the finding that it's not set in stone.
Don't Buddhist monks use these techniques for very different reasons than you emphasize in the book? It's not to ease our modern world afflictions like anxiety or insomnia or even age-related diseases, or to attain happiness in the Western sense, but rather to attain spiritual enlightenment?
Exactly. I mean, happiness is not a goal. It's a byproduct. So when they are engaging in, again, compassion meditation, which is the practice of hoping that all sentient beings be free from suffering, they feel, or they report, that this enables them, again, to go out into the world and to give themselves to others in a more empathic, a more altruistic way. But if a feeling of well-being is a byproduct of not only the actions, but also the meditation, which it seems to be, I mean, that's where the Dalai Lama and those around him have hopes that it can carry over into the, you know, non-monk community.
So if it just so happens to work for this other stuff, even though that's not why it was developed, then you as a science writer, people as, you know, meditation group marketers, whatever, are going to use it.
And again, to me, it's, you know, less of a here are 12 ways to happiness than another piece of evidence that the brain is malleable in important ways.
30 seconds. Did you as a science journalist come to this with any skepticism at first because of the religion hook?
Huge skepticism, because I, like everybody else, has written about how science and faith are at loggerheads, and it was refreshing to see that Buddhism really is not.
Sharon Begley is a science columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Her new book is called Train Your Mind, Change Your Brain, How a New Science Reveals Our Extraordinary Potential to Transform Ourselves. It's published by Ballantine Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.